Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. President Obama's historic trip to Cuba received headlines and analysis around the globe. There are two narratives in the United States about policy in Cuba. Opponents argue that normalizing relations between the U.S. and Cuba should not come at the expense of ignoring human rights, while proponents argue that the U.S.-Cuba relationship can help human rights issues in Cuba. These narratives are driving most media coverage of Cuba, a country of 11 million people. So how should the media report on Cuba? For many Americans, the image of Cuba is frozen in time. Roque Planas was in Cuba during President Obama's trip. He is the editor of the Huffington Post Latino Voices section. Hi, Roque. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. And APAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Conference, held its annual gathering last weekend. As always, presidential candidates pledged their unwavering support for Israel. Both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton received multiple standing ovations. Professor and author Juan Cole said Hillary Clinton announced a set of policies that do not differ from those of the far-right Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. So how are the media covering the conference and APAC's influence? Eli Clifton covered the conference. He's been covering APAC for many years. He's a fellow at the Nation Institute. He focuses on U.S. foreign policy. He's co-author of the Center for American Progress's report, Fear, Inc., The Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America. Hi, Eli. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. So Eli Clifton, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, to take a very different focus than I think what we'll be discussing for the rest of this hour, the long-form piece that really struck me was published on the Highline, which is the Huffington Post's long-form sort of section. It's called Out Here, No One Can Hear You Scream. It's by Catherine Joyce. It was reported in conjunction with the Investigative Fund here at the Nation Institute that I've done a lot of work with, so it's self-interest here in promoting it. But I think it's a fantastic piece about the history of gender discrimination, sexual harassment, and sexual assault in the National Park Service, and how specifically looking at the culture of the boatmen, as they're called, the men who pilot the boats in the Grand Canyon for the Forest Service, showing how much like sort of tailhook or the history of sexual harassment and discrimination in the military, there are a group of men, as it were, in the Forest Service who have sort of been treated as above the law, who perceive themselves as being irreplaceable, and for a large part, for at least a couple decades, have largely been able to behave in these ways without any risk or threat of consequences.
You know, I'm really glad you brought this up. I started reading this article last week, and I got so angry and upset that I just stopped. There's some sexual harassment cases going on at Berkeley. I mean, it's just endless. So can you tell us what is happening because of this? Are there investigations? Is anything being done about this?
You know, there are investigations. People have been suspended. People have been fired. It's not that there's been a total lack of action. But what is really striking is that this is something that's been happening over decades, and it really continues to be that way. Obviously, they haven't dealt with the problem to the same degree that the military has. The military still has a problem with sexual harassment and sexual assault, but it's much more in the open, the discussion about it, and the fact that there's an acknowledgement from senior leadership that this is something that has to be addressed. What you see in the Forest Service is still this trend of penalizing the women who bring forward the complaints. The idea that even amongst the men who might be sympathetic to wanting to help with a report of sexual harassment, that they feel like their careers will be put in jeopardy if they cooperate. It really indicates that there's a systemic problem that, and one hates to keep using the U.S. military as the best example of how to deal with institutionalized problems like this, but certainly seeing the military's sexual assault problems get addressed over the past few years and new initiatives and of the public debate about it, it just shows how far behind the Forest Service is dealing with similar problems.
So kudos to Catherine Joyce for the story. Video and photos are by Emily Cassie, and it's called Out Here, No One Can Hear You Scream, The Dangerous Culture of Male Entitlement and Sexual Hostility Hiding Within America's National Parks and Forests. And this was a collaboration between the Huffington Post Investigative Fund and Highline. I'm so glad you brought this up, Eli. I'm definitely going to finish this over the weekend. Thank you. That's Eli Clifton, a fellow at the Nation Institute. And what about you, Roque Planas? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Excellent. Yeah, and first off, I just wanted to thank y'all for the shout-out to Highline. It's a project that we're really proud of. It's put out a lot of great material here at the Huffington Post. But one of the things that I saw this week, sort of in preparing to come and talk about what's going on in Cuba, is actually a bit older article, but I think that it's very important now, looking at what's going on with, you know, the aftermath of Obama's visit and so forth. And it's an article that was put out by Bloomberg called Want to Do Business in Cuba, Prepare to Partner with the General. And it's all about Raul Castro's son-in-law, Luis Alberto Rodriguez, who's a military official who controls Galleza, which is the holding company that Cuba uses to deal with foreign investments, and they manage the largest enterprises in tourism and other areas of the Cuban economy. It's a very, very powerful institution that not a lot of people know about. And what I really liked about this piece is that it gets into those very sort of detailed questions about how Cuba's government works, how Cuba's looking at engaging with the rest of the world. And it was very enterprising in the sense that the Cuban government is rather opaque, and it's very difficult for reporters to get an idea of what they're really thinking. And I thought that this reporter, you know, went the extra mile, and that he did also do a really good job in looking at how the changes that are going on in Galleza and the way that Cuba is approaching foreign investment is trickling down to the general public, and did a really good job of sort of showing how people are reacting to those changes. And it's very important now, because after Obama's visit, I think, you know, particularly the tourism economy is going to become extremely important for a lot of Cubans who are expecting that, you know, this newer relationship with the United States is going to have some kind of positive impact in their life.
Right. So, all right, that sounds like a really good article, and we're going to talk about this issue in just a few minutes. So kudos to Bloomberg's Michael Smith, and the piece is Want to Do Business in Cuba, Prepare to Partner with the General. And that is Roque Planas. He is editor of the Huffington Post Latino Voices section, and we'll put links at yourcallradio.org. So since you brought up business, Roque, let's talk about this, because the fact that President Obama traveled with business people to Cuba got a lot of attention. There's a piece by your colleague, Willa Frege. Starwood and Airbnb are poised to take Cuba's hospitality industry by storm. There was another piece at the Miami Herald. Carnival gets approval to start cruising from Miami to Cuba on May 1st. And then U.S. agribusiness is seen green in Cuba. This is by Christopher Cook at Vice. The New York Times had a piece, To Beat the Rush, Americans Rush to Cuba, Overloading Services. But what I see missing in a lot of stories is, how are the Cubans going to be affected by this?
Right. I mean, I think, really one of the sad things about the way this, I mean, I think it's really great that there's this new sort of push to engage with Cuba commercially and economically, because the fact of the matter is the public really needs it. It's very difficult to get by on what a Cuban can make in a state salary job, which I think the average salary is somewhere around the equivalent of U.S. $30. And it's very difficult to make it. But, you know,
$30?
$30 American dollars a month.
A month?
Yeah.
That's the average. Little. The average salary.
That's the average salary, correct. So, I mean, Cubans don't pay rent and so forth, but it's extremely little. And there's a dual economy, so that the Cuban national peso can buy things at a cheaper price than the convertible peso, which would be roughly equivalent to $1. But, you know, it's low. And so the thing is that Cuba's industry has really fell apart after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And what you're seeing now is a big push to move into primarily tourism. The government has plans to expand, you know, investments in agriculture with a special economic zone at Mariel, where they can try to get more manufacturing again. But most Cubans are really seeing this impact in tourism. You know, they uniformly described Obama's trip as a very positive thing because they hope that American tourists will come along with it. Because imagine if you're making the equivalent of $30 in a state job, you might make close to that in just tips if you're driving a cab in a day. So that's where Cubans are the most hopeful, at least in Havana, and at least in the short term, for making more money.
And have you seen much coverage, though, about how this will affect Cubans? Because, I mean, you can't help but think about what happens when multinationals go to other countries. People still make slave wages. They have no labor protections. In fact, in the case of Bangladesh, you've got buildings crashing down. I mean, have you seen much reporting about that?
I haven't. I'm also quite behind on the reporting because Cuba is connected by a 2G satellite connection to the outside world with very little Wi-Fi. So, I was focused very much on my reporting and writing while I was down there. But, I think the thing to really keep focus on here in terms of what the Obama administration is attempting to do, right? Most of what has been, so for us, for the United States, investment in Cuba remains largely restricted by the embargo, which remains in effect and needs an act of Congress to overturn. So where Obama's been able to carve out these exemptions has been through things like Airbnb. So like when I was down there, I stayed in the home of a couple who live in one apartment and rent the second apartment. And I think for a two-bedroom thing, they were charging $70 or something like that for a night. The Cuban government takes, with share and taxes, but that's quite a good business for them. Now, the logic in allowing Airbnb to operate in Cuba that the U.S. government used, or that the Obama administration used to justify it, was to say that money that's going to the Airbnb person who's renting out their apartment, that's money that's going directly to a Cuban citizen. They may pay taxes, but that's money that's going directly to them. So the issue of, are you giving the money straight to the government and sort of ignoring workers' rights is a little bit skirted by that approach. Now, the Starwood deal, as far as I can tell, that's just a U.S. company partnering with the Cuban government to renovate a hotel. I have a really hard time wrapping my mind about how that's justified under the embargo, but I think for those, particularly those who oppose the economic engagement of Cuba, like, particularly the Cuban American community in South Florida, this people-to-people engagement, sort of approaching economic development in Cuba by investing directly in enterprises that are done by Cuban citizens, I think is something that can take the sting out of what to them feels like defeat.
Eli, you have been following coverage of Cuba, which didn't get as much attention as it probably would have because of what happened in Brussels. But there are really two narratives in the United States about policy in Cuba. Opponents argue that normalizing relations between the U.S. and Cuba shouldn't come at the expense of ignoring human rights. And then proponents argue that U.S.-Cuba relations can actually improve human rights in Cuba. And these are the narratives that are driving most of the media coverage. How do you think this new relationship will change coverage of Cuba? Because for many Americans, the image is really frozen in time.
Well, I think it's interesting that we talk about the end of the embargo or Obama's efforts to sort of define some areas through executive action to override it, as it were, as working against the discussion of human rights in Cuba. Because to tell you the truth, I think in the past, since Obama announced what he was intending to do, we've actually had more discussion of human rights in Cuba than we really have at any time in the past couple decades. This is not something that really is in the media's, in the mainstream media or even alternative media all that much. Obviously there's an interest in Cuba, but a lot of the interest has to do with how can Americans get there, because Americans are interested in it, how can we, and whether or not it's justifiable to end the embargo. But in terms of getting into the nitty-gritty of the current human rights situation in Cuba, I think we're actually hearing more about it now than we have before. And I think probably a very interesting example of that was watching live the press conference with Raul Castro and Obama in Cuba, with Raul Castro actually answering questions from international journalists live on network television about human rights. This is something that it's very hard to imagine having occurred under any other set of circumstances And I would hope at least that that the mainstream media does keep up the pressure on human rights and pressuring the Cuban government to answer those questions, because one perhaps unintended side effect of the embargo is that certainly Cuban diplomats and the Cuban leadership were in many ways sheltered from being exposed to those types of questions and that type of pressure.
Roque, what really stood out for you about that press conference and the questions that were asked?
I mean, I think, you know, the same thing. It was really great to see Raul question on human rights. I think one thing that he said that's very easy to dismiss because Cuba's a totalitarian government is that Cuba also has its own issues with human rights in the United States. And I thought it was actually very, nice of Obama to acknowledge that there is some common ground there in terms of wanting to guarantee economic rights that have been a priority of the revolution, you know, the access to healthcare, access to education, and so forth. So, and I think one of the things that was really overshadowed that didn't get enough attention at all is that, you know, Raul Castro was asked when he's going to release the political prisoners, and he sort of, you know, was very dismissive and said that there's no political prisoners in Cuba, but it would be, I think, very helpful for the United States to do its own part to close Gitmo and maybe even get it back, if, you know, in order to maintain the moral high ground in a conversation like that. But I think there's also a larger trend that's going on, and I would agree with everything that Eli said about how disengagement with the government is opening up the conversation. I think one of the things that's happening right now in Cuba that's so crucial and interesting is that you have really a sort of flourishing of a small but independent and, you know, sort of growing independent space for people to operate in, where they're not working with the government. You know, you have a growing movement of independent journalists, you know, sort of doing traditional accountability kind of reporting. I mean, they're not widely read, but they're there. You have people starting their own businesses. You have people feeling what I think is just I see Cuba shedding this siege mentality that has justified a very large security state that really doesn't need to exist anymore. And that's a very positive development for human rights that I think, you know, deserves more attention than perhaps it's receiving.
In the recent deal with Iran, human rights were not on the table. Do you think that this is just something that the United States is talking about, and or do you think that there will be more attention on this? Or is it all about business?
I mean, I think that it's all about politics. South Florida Cuban American community is going to make very sure that that any engagement with Cuba addresses human rights concerns that for them are very real and very personal, and I think that that's a good thing. I wish that we had the same sorts of discussions when we talked about policy toward Mexico, because you don't see anyone talk about shutting down a relationship with Mexico over the, you know, just tons of human rights abuses that you have in that country, in which government officials are directly implicated. So I think that, you know, that Cuba's got kind of a unique situation because they have, you know, a very impassioned group that is pushing this agenda. I think it's a good thing. I wish I saw it happen more often in the region. I mean, I think that the United States has a tendency to really play up human rights issues when they're dealing with an adversarial relationship and to completely ignore it when they're dealing with an ally.
Roque Planas is the editor of the Huffington Post Latino Voices section. He was in Cuba during President Obama's trip there, and you can find his writing at yourcallradio.org. Eli Clifton is a fellow at the Nation Institute who focuses on U.S. foreign policy. We'll be talking with Eli later in the show about coverage of the AIPAC conference. If you have a question or comment about media coverage of Cuba, what are your thoughts on what you saw this week? And how do you think U.S.-Cuba relations will change mainstream reporting on Cuba? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Roque, we have an email from Mark who says, let's hope the environment doesn't get lost in the rush for profits. One of the world's only remaining healthy reefs versus the runoff from 1,500 proposed golf courses, for example, is in Cuba.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly a natural concern. And my understanding is that the Cuban government is certainly pushing in that direction. But I think also, you know, I mean, to my mind, Cuba has is pretty strongly placed in terms of dealing with environmental issues, because the society, by necessity, just simply isn't that destructive. I mean, Cuban society doesn't produce a lot of trash. Cubans, you know, don't produce a lot of waste, because there's a lot of necessity in Cuba. And every time the government wastes something, that's a cost to the government, because they're on the hook to provide for the Cuban public, you know, in a very real way, to have all these commitments because of the communist system. So, I mean, I think certainly it's a big issue. It's one that should be addressed. I think it's, you know, obviously one that should be addressed jointly. I mean, there's also concerns about making sure that Cuba's oil exploration is done in the most responsible way possible, because it's right off the shore of Florida. But yeah, I mean, I think to me that concern should also be tempered by understanding that Cuba is just a very the kind of society that isn't doing very much damage to the environment. I mean, I would put it as one of the least defensive governments that I can imagine in the world.
Hmm. Let's hear next from Anne. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the show.
Hi. This dovetails into that last point, because I think we really need to be concerned about what our impact is going to be as things open up. My call in particular was about the gold mine of classic cars that the residents are sitting on, and that there's probably already collectors over there now trying to, you know, get them for cheap. You know, and while that's, you know, old economic story, if that happens a lot, it could affect our relationship diplomatically. I mean, we don't want to go over there and let a lot of people basically scam a lot of locals who could really use the windfall of their cars. And what does that do to the character of Havana, you know, from a tourist standpoint? I mean, these things really should be things that we think about before we let people basically prey on locals because they need money. You know, and has anybody even thought about what all those cars are worth? There are some people really literally sitting on a gold mine.
Yeah, I mean, there were so many photos of those cars over the past week. According to this New York Times piece about the American rush to Cuba, Francis Robles reports that the sharp increase in American travel to Cuba is putting a strain on private and state businesses on the island, leading to some shortages and an abrupt rise in prices that will only steepen as more Americans take advantage of relaxed travel regulations. What are your thoughts on this, Roquet, and Anne's concerns?
I mean, I think they're all very real concerns. I think, you know, from that, well, I guess sort of from the point of view of the Cuban public, I think that, like I said before, I think that the desire for increased tourism is uniform across the board for anyone connected, even remotely, to the tourist economy, because it's the one thing that is in the short term providing money. I think people would be thrilled to sell their cars if they have them, and if they can get a price that they think is worth more than driving it. So now, having said that, the whole strategy of the Cuban government has been slow, incremental change, and that's been true for a really long time. I haven't, you know, personally tried to buy a car in Cuba, and I don't know what the implications would be in order for taking it out. I would imagine that there are some kind of, well, I don't want to speculate too much, but I imagine that's something that the Cuban bureaucracy has thought of, and that they try to, you know, exercise some restriction over. Like I said, the Cuban government likes things to be slow, incremental. They like to see what's coming next. But, yeah, I mean, in answer to that, I just think that, you know, it's a tough thing, because one of the things that makes people want to go to Cuba is that it's so different. But, you know, on the other hand, Cubans themselves are really trying to make things change as rapidly as possible. I mean, I think on the boat you have that tension on both sides, you know, people who want to go there before Cuba changes and Cubans who want Cuba to change as fast as possible.
And Eli, over the past 7 or so years, President Obama's foreign policy accomplishments, according to many, can be traced back to his willingness to engage in diplomacy. And in 2007, during the debate, then-candidate Obama said he would be willing to meet without preconditions with the leaders of Iran, Syria, Venezuela, Cuba, and North Korea. And at the time, Hillary Clinton said, quote, "I don't want to be used for propaganda purposes," end quote. What is Hillary Clinton's stance on Cuba? I haven't heard many comments from her about this trip.
I haven't heard much from her either, come to think of it. Certainly the thought that comes to mind when you say that is that, you know, it wasn't just in 2008 that Hillary Clinton was saying those things. Hillary Clinton was making similar comments just a few months ago when Bernie Sanders talked about the possibility of normalizing relations with Iran and reopening a U.S. embassy in Tehran. This has been a consistent theme in her foreign policy positions, is at least attacking Democrats who have expressed, in her view, a reckless willingness to engage in conversation and in negotiations with rivals. As for Cuba, actually that's a very interesting question, and I really should look and see. I have so far not seen much comment from her. I think one thing that has changed, obviously, in the past 8 years is that Hillary Clinton has become, or at least in this election cycle, is very cautious about creating any daylight between her and Barack Obama's foreign policy. And I think a lot of that has to do with Obama's relative popularity within the Democratic Party, the fact that, for instance, the Iran deal, and for that matter, the move toward improved relations with Cuba are not unpopular within the Democratic Party, and certainly aren't deal breakers for in a general election. So I think a lot of that goes into her sort of eagerness to, at one level, hit Bernie Sanders for expressing many of the same positions that Obama did in 2008, while at the same time not creating any daylight between her and the administration.
Roque, what's your take on it?
I mean, yeah, I think that's all very accurate. And I think, but there's one thing that I would just highlight that I think is really key to understanding what makes Obama's move on Cuba so different and why he was able to make it happen. I think when you look, I was just recently rereading the sort of bit that Hillary Clinton wrote in her memoir about Honduras, and that section is all about actually about Cuba, you know, because at the time the Latin American governments were trying to bring Cuba into the OAS. And what she said about Cuba, you know, is a very familiar talking point, right, which is that she wants to get rid of the embargo because the Cuban government uses it as an excuse to justify its failures and its security apparatus. What Obama articulated, and what I think is going to be and what I think is very important for Latin American governments, and I think he kind of really nailed this, was Obama articulated a very clear policy of non-intervention. Now, I mean, in practice is one thing, but he articulated a very clear policy of non-intervention. It wasn't that he's changing the policy because he thinks it will be more successful in overthrowing the Castro government. He was saying he's changing the policy because it's destructive, it's not working, and that Cuba's future should belong to Cubans. And I think that that's a really important distinction between it's subtle, but it's a really important distinction between his approach and Hillary Clinton's approach, because the most important thing that he did when he was in Cuba was to really open up, he's really helping pry open that space for people to have independence, and he's making it harder for the Castro government to justify this very lopsided security apparatus, because it's all justified on the notion that the United States is trying to invade Cuba, or trying to actively overthrow the government, which is actually stated U.S. policy. But you know, that's the real, to me, the real sort of key of Obama's visit. He's allowing much more space to Cuban people by taking away this justification for the Cuban government's security apparatus.
Roque, since you brought up Hillary Clinton's memoir, you had a piece called "Hillary Clinton's Response to Honduran Coup Was Scrubbed from Her Paperback Memoirs." Critics argue the Secretary of State's efforts paved the way for the violence still plaguing Honduras. Can you talk about that?
Sure. And I mean, this is why I say that the Obama's articulation of a policy of non-intervention, you know, I mean, one thing is what he's saying, and one thing is the way that it happens, because that was obviously under the Obama's White House that happened. But when the coup in Honduras happened, you know, basically Hillary Clinton had tried, you know, to sort of skirt the OAS's influence, where Latin American governments wanted to restore the ousted leader and instead cobble together this agreement with the former Costa Rican president and the Honduran government. And ultimately, that's what happened. So, you know, I mean, I guess I don't really have that much more to add than what's in the piece, but I do think that that a Hillary Clinton White House would have a sort of a different tenor than the Obama White House. I mean, right now Obama is in Argentina trying, you know, on the anniversary of the coup that ushered in this really violent military dictatorship that the United States was very sort of supportive of. And, you know, it has that trip, from what I'm seeing, doesn't have the same sort of positive tenor that the Cuba trip did. But he really is, to my mind, as far as I can see, trying to do something to turn the page on this really ugly history of intervention. And I think, you know, for him to end his tenure in the White House with these moves is something that's going to be remembered in Latin America, even if in Argentina right now they're protesting heavily and people are very resentful still over what happened. I think that these kinds of moves are just really positive for U.S. Latin American relations more generally.
Well, Roque, I want to thank you for joining us. Roque Planas is editor of the Huffington Post Latino Voices section. He just returned from a trip to Cuba. Roque, thank you for joining us.
My great pleasure.
And coming up after the break, Eli Clifton, fellow at the Nation Institute, will join us to talk about coverage of the AIPAC conference. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
You can join today's conversation toll-free, 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free call, or send your email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, Inflection Point. On the program today, Lauren Schiller's guests will be renowned photographer Annie Leibovitz, talking about her exhibition on tour, Women, New Portraits, now up at the Presidio's Crissy Field, plus Dr. Delaney Rustin, the director of the new film Screenagers, on what all this screen time is doing to our kids' brains. That's Inflection Point, coming up in 30 minutes at 11 o'clock here on KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will have a conversation about the growing protests against the hateful and xenophobic rhetoric in the presidential race. Recent protests at Donald Trump's rallies in Chicago, Phoenix, and other cities across the country have sparked a debate about effective strategies to stand up to hateful speech. So what do you think? What is the right way to resist hate? That is on Monday. We are also putting shows together about voting. So far, we've seen major problems. In Arizona, for example, 5-hour lines. They actually called the race while people were standing in line. So we're going to talk about why, in 2016, people are still having a hard time voting in the United States. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our media roundtable, and we are joined by Eli Clifton. He's a fellow at the Nation Institute. He focuses on money and politics and U.S. foreign policy. He's co-author of the Center for American Progress's report, Fear, Inc., The Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America. And we're going to talk now about coverage of the annual AIPAC conference. The American Israel Public Affairs Council held its conference last weekend. Presidential candidates pledged their unwavering support for Israel. Bernie Sanders declined to show up in person, but according to reports, he offered to do a video conference and he was turned down. Eli, what really struck you about coverage this year? I mean, as always, presidents go and they talk about their support for Israel. They get standing ovations. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump both got multiple standing ovations. Of course, it was different this year because Donald Trump was there.
Right. Donald Trump was there. That certainly was the headline, and that was where most of the interest and media attention, that was the angle it came from. But I think certainly the subtext of a lot of this was also that this was AIPAC coming out of a particularly bruising year for the organization. You know, they went to the mat with the administration, fighting Obama on the Iran deal. They sided with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and with the Republican Party in taking on a popular U.S. president who was pursuing his signature foreign policy achievement for his second term, and they lost big. They failed to whip Democrats to stand with them, and the Democratic Party has traditionally been AIPAC's base. Jewish Americans typically vote Democratic. They are not perceived as a swing vote. There's jokes made that African Americans and Jewish Americans are the two groups that are the least often in play, so to speak, in an election cycle. These are folks that vote Democratic. And it seemed as if the organization was offsides over the past year. This time around, certainly Trump stole the limelight, largely based off of his hostility to the White House. And it was pretty remarkable watching somebody get up on the stage there, Ted Cruz did it as well, and take shot after shot after shot at a Democratic president. It went so far that AIPAC's president, Lillian Pincus, actually repudiated Trump's comments, saying, "We say unequivocally that we do not countenance ad hominem attacks, and we take great offense against those that are levied against the President of the United States from our stage." Now, that was the organization speaking. The audience, on the other hand, was giving Trump standing ovations for this. And that's what was pretty remarkable to watch, is that the audience seemed to only be measuring the candidates on really one score sheet. And that score sheet was if the candidates pledged to make no daylight between an increasingly right-wing Israeli government and the United States. And both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump aced that test.
Right. Jay Michelson at the Daily Beast had a piece called AIPAC's Ovation for Trump is Not at All Surprising. And he wrote, is it at all surprising that a rightward-tilting, nationalistic, often anti-Muslim pep rally of 18,000 people, many paid to be there by a handful of billionaires, would applaud a rightward-tilting, nationalistic, often anti-Muslim leader of pep rallies?
Well, I would say yes, it is surprising. And Peter Beinart, I think, addressed this pretty directly in his piece in Haaretz, which I think went up yesterday, which said, as he wrote, the most dominant Jewish organization in America is indifferent to what happens in America. And really, you need to look more at the sort of the broader history of American Zionists, and a lot of them were really opposed to economic oligarchy. They were supportive of progressive movements of the time, such as women's rights, civil rights, the labor movement. As Beinart points out, the American Jewish Committee and the American Jewish Congress they employed more attorneys to end segregation than the Justice Department did at the time in the 1940s. So things have definitely changed. And what was so noticeable is that while Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump differ on pretty much everything when it comes to domestic policy, when it came to pledging no daylight between their administrations or their potential administrations and Netanyahu, they both were on the same page. And that seemed to be the only way in which this audience was grading the candidates. There was just a lot of speculation before the event, wondering how big the walkout would be for Donald Trump, asking if there would be people heckling him. It seemed as if the protests were very minimal on the floor of the convention center. It was really quite remarkable to see that there was very little backlash for Trump and his anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant positions, which historically would have been seen as way outside of what would be the acceptable discourse for a Jewish American constituency.
What struck you about the coverage that Hillary Clinton received? Professor and author Juan Cole said Hillary Clinton announced a set of policies that do not differ from those of the far-right Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Well, she certainly has bent over backwards not to put herself in the same confrontational role that Obama has often found himself in with Netanyahu. Now, I guess there's two things to be said about that. One of those is that Obama hasn't always chosen to be put himself in that role either. Netanyahu made a decision at some point that it was better to publicly work against Obama than to find areas of cooperation. And that goes back to probably 2009 when Netanyahu lost his temper over Obama's proposal to halt Israeli settlements. And it's been downhill since then. Year one of his administration or year two of his administration, and it's only gotten worse for them. That said, Hillary Clinton certainly has a lot of reasons to try to have a better relationship, and one of those has to do with securing the support of pro-Israel hawks on the left, such as Haim Saban, one of her biggest campaign donors. And it would seem as if her positions opposing the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement has a lot to do with appeasing Haim Saban and some of her other deep-pocketed supporters.
Can you tell us more about Haim Saban? According to the Wrap, Saban Capital Group has donated $6.4 million to Hillary Clinton's official campaign, the pro-Clinton Super PAC Priorities USA.
And they've certainly, there's always speculation about influence peddled to the Clinton Foundation, and Saban and his companies have contributed many millions more to the Clinton Foundation over the past 10 years or so. Saban has emerged as sort of the Sheldon Adelson of the left, where he's perceived as having, direct access to Hillary Clinton. Someone who has also advocated for military action against Iran. He shared a stage with Sheldon Adelson at events. They tried to cooperate on sort of an anti-BDS campaign together, but apparently there was a falling out of some sort between Adelson and Saban. But he's certainly the most outspoken and the most high-profile pro-Israel hawk, as it were, or pro-Likud, Benjamin Netanyahu's party, hawk on the left, or at least associated with the Democratic Party.
Manda Weiss got a copy of a letter that Hillary Clinton wrote to Haim Saban and said that she will be speaking out publicly against BDS.
That's right, and I believe she mentioned it in her AIPAC speech. It has become a sort of a hot button topic for politicians who want to prove their pro-Israel credentials and appeasing, as I say, these sort of hawkish corners in both political parties who are supportive of very aggressive policies toward Palestinians, opposing the Iran nuclear agreement, and it sort of seems like the third component of that is always opposing BDS. What's so remarkable is that BDS, it's unlikely that it would actually lead to severe economic pains for Israel. What we're talking about is getting, for instance, university endowments to divest from companies doing business in settlements. It's a little hard to imagine how big an impact that would have, but its symbolic value appears to be growing pretty much by the day.
Eli Clifton is a fellow at the Nation Institute who focuses on U.S. foreign policy. And today we're talking with Eli about media coverage of the AIPAC conference. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Daniel in Oakland. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. Eli, legislatures throughout the nation and cities have come out against BDS. That most Jews oppose BDS because Israel is singled out. You don't have calls for BDS against most of the world's tyrannies. Only democratic Israel is singled out. So when you correlate opposition to BDS with hawks, I think it reflects quite a bias. And I give Hillary Clinton a lot of credit because she's come out against the singular bias against the democratic state.
Eli?
Well, I think the soft bigotry of low expectations kind of comes to mind with that. That certainly the American Jewish community, who I associate myself as being a member of, as well as non-Jews who consider themselves pro-Israel and supportive of Israel as a democratic country, do hold Israel to a higher standard. And it's because Israel holds itself to a higher standard, perceiving itself as a liberal democracy in a region that's not known for that. So when an expectation of higher expectations. When higher expectations are applied to Israel than to some of the same countries in the region, I think it's really attributable to two things. One is that Israel is perceived as reaching for higher values and for being a liberal democracy, but also because Israel and the United States are very close allies. And it's perceived that Israel's mistreatment of Palestinians, the ongoing occupation, the expansion of settlements, reflect poorly on the United States and on its supporters in the United States.
And for those who aren't very familiar with BDS, Eli, can you describe it?
Well, I mean, as it was just pointed out, that at this point, it is mostly limited to, from what I've seen, to efforts to get investment funds, often at college endowments, university endowments, some pension funds, divested from certain types of Israeli companies that are doing business in settlements or in the West Bank. There are some broader attempts to target Israeli academic institutions, which I think have largely fallen flat to the best of my knowledge. And it's largely voluntary with, as I say, pension funds can choose to invest or divest how they choose to. It's very hard to legislate that. And I think, frankly, it really is misrepresenting it to characterize it as discrimination against all of Israel or against all Jewish Americans. What it is attempting to do is to say that there are certain types of investments in Israel that are counter to maybe Israeli democratic values and to liberal American progressive values.
What did you think about the coverage that Bernie Sanders did or did not get? He declined to attend the AIPAC conference in person. Reportedly, he offered to speak via video, but that offer was turned down. He gave a Middle East foreign policy speech in Utah, where he was campaigning in Salt Lake City. And in that speech, he insisted that, quote, peace also means security for every Palestinian. It means achieving self-determination, civil rights, and economic well-being for the Palestinian people. He said peace will also mean ending the economic blockade of Gaza. It will mean a sustainable and equitable distribution of precious water resources so that Israel and Palestine can both thrive as neighbors. And The Intercept pointed out that very few in the broadcast media covered this speech.
That's true. And I think that it's worth also just examining the fact that he was not allowed to appear via video at AIPAC. In the past, AIPAC has accommodated that request. And incidentally, AIPAC has also chosen not to have presidential candidates appear, namely Ron Paul in 2012, who they perceived as being counter to the organization. So I think that there were some very interesting aspects of that they didn't want to give him that stage and give him that platform to make comments which acknowledged the suffering of Palestinians and to suggest that regional security, Israel's security, and Palestinian security all really were dependent on ending the occupation and reaching a two-state solution where there were two countries with mutually assured security agreements between them, which would guarantee, as they say, not just Israeli security, Palestinian as well, and end suffering on both sides of that border.
And Eli, in the independent media, the fact that Bernie Sanders talked about Palestinians, suffering Palestinians, made headlines. What do you think that says about the discourse in the United States?
I mean, I think it's fascinating that he was that it was considered radical that he had said that.
Right.
This is the type of language. Certainly, Hillary Clinton at different points has also acknowledged that Palestinians are suffering. Obama has acknowledged Palestinian suffering, and there are Israelis who acknowledge Palestinian suffering. So it is not unheard of for politicians or Americans or Israelis to express this. But it does show where we are, that in the election cycle in March of 2016, that there's really only one candidate who perceives that it is politically viable to make that statement a fact.
We have an email from Hassan in Berkeley, who says, you are correctly discussing the corrupting influence on the Israel lobby on our elections and politics. I'll ask you about that in a minute. He says, we should also be concerned about the influence locally. A recent example is the resolution by UC Regents 2 days ago implying that criticizing Zionism and the Israeli government, sorry, I just lost my email, is anti-Semitism. This amounts to suppression of academic freedom and censoring protected free speech. We can criticize the American government, criticize Jesus Christ, question the existence of God, but according to the UC Regents, one cannot criticize what's happening, the human rights violations and racism in Israel-Palestine. Eli, as a reporter who's covered these issues for years, why is this?
I think that there's been a growing movement to try to associate criticism of Israel, the Israeli government, and Israeli government policies with anti-Semitism. I've seen that grow over maybe the past 5 years, trying to pass these types of resolutions at universities, and even sort of enforcing it more broadly in the media, has become a strategy that's used with increasing frequency. And I think one of the reasons for it is, frankly, desperation, that it's increasingly difficult to defend some of the policies undertaken by Netanyahu, the expansion of settlements, the disproportionate death toll that's imposed on Gaza, the restriction on Palestinian movement, the total lack of progress on a two-state solution, and Palestinian leadership as well as Israeli deserve plenty of blame for that. But the fact that that it's gotten to this point, I think it's a sign of desperation that that now there's a new movement to say that any criticism of Israel is equated with anti-Semitism. I think it's a perversion of the word anti-Semitism. I think it is hugely disrespectful to victims of anti-Semitism, and it shows a carelessness to any serious efforts to learn from the past and stamp out bigotry and anti-Semitism wherever it exists. I do want to step back for a moment, though, and say that I think the concept of the Israel lobby as monolithic is also problematic. It's not. For instance, J Street supported the Iran nuclear deal. Americans for Peace Now supported the nuclear deal. There are plenty of Jewish groups that would be grouped into the Israel lobby that split with AIPAC. The lobby is not monolithic, and the cleavages within it are actually rather fascinating to look at right now.
Eli Clifton is a fellow at the Nation Institute and co-author of the Center for American Progress's report, Fear, Inc., The Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America. His work also appears in the Loeb Log. Eli, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the growing protests against the hateful and xenophobic rhetoric in the presidential race. The recent protests at Donald Trump's rallies in Chicago, Phoenix, and other cities across the country have sparked a debate about effective strategies to stand up to hateful speech. What is the right way to resist hate? And what does a powerful nonviolent protest look like? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Area, what do you want to know about the Bay Area? How much of the Berkeley School District budget goes to teachers?
Why do the sewers in San Francisco flood when it rains?
How many more drivers are on the road now than there were 5 years ago?
You ask the questions and we'll find the answer. Head to KALW.org and look for the box that says Hey Area. Type your question there. We'll assign reporters to investigate and report back here on KALW San Francisco.
More details at KALW.org. Inflection Point is coming up next. Following that at 12 o'clock today, it's our weekly presentation of the Tavis Smiley Show. At 1 o'clock, Latino USA, and then at 2, a full hour of news analysis and headlines from London on BBC NewsHour. It's 11 o'clock, and this is KALW San Francisco, local public radio.
Welcome to Inflection Point, conversations with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. Today on Inflection Point, why is it so important to control our kids' screen time?
Self-control is really the number one predictor for success in life, even more than IQ.
And is success defined by being on the cover of a magazine?
Don't give me a cover to do. I don't want to do a cover. I want to do the inside photographs. It's the inside photographs that are the real photographs.
Dr. Delaney Rustin, director of the new documentary, Screenagers, and a Bay Area broadcast exclusive with photographer Annie Leibovitz. That's today on Inflection Point. Stay tuned.